Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
I actually forgot about that. Like, I know I remember stuff when prompted, but I had totally forgotten that we had that war with the convoy. Look, it was because they were, I know Richard's mad at me talking about, I don't even know what's in the New York Times today. I didn't see it. But no, I didn't want the convoy to keep breaking the law in James Bay and honking at people and harassing them all day and causing downtown businesses to have problems. And Vic PD had set up that barricade to try to help the folks at James Bay after they got harassed for weeks by the convoy earlier this year. And one of them actually tried to 4x4 across Beacon Hill Park at one point. Was I hard on them? Yeah, I was. And, you know, they spent a lot of time also online talking about me on their Zello chat.
Hey, does anybody have a direct line for Adam Sterling? I'd like to talk to Adam Sterling.
See, that's the thing. Everybody's like, oh, it's the first time I've ever had an online mob come after me. No, it just happens a lot for some reason.
Can I talk to Adam Sterling?
I would love to, challenge him on the airwaves.
They never did call in.
Ask and ye shall receive there, Mr. Chris. I luckily do have Adam Sterling's phone number, so there you go.
Who is Adam Sterling?
He's a...
I think they were about to swear, so I didn't say that. And then they, like, ended up talking to each other, saying that they should just leave James Bay alone, because... And they said me.
It's a show. It's a demonstration. That's all it is. Now, if we're demonstrating without public opinion, then not even the government's going to turn an ear to us. And that's why you got people like Adam Sterling or the Czech News picking apart our videos and our live streams, because they know they got the support by the people, because the people no longer support us. They support us being terrorists.
This is what the convoy was saying, like, while it was happening. And, of course, when Ron Clark showed up on May 11th.
Like Adam Sterling from CFAX. You know, I was listening to some of his stuff yesterday, and he likes to, like, belittle people.
Yeah, well, you know, the convoy left, and, you know, they caused problems. I told them I didn't like their problems. They said they didn't like me. I said, well, okay, lots of people don't like me. I'm still going to say what I'm going to say, and at the end of the day, I'm still here doing this. And the convoy, I'd actually forgotten about them. I was back in May, June, July, August. That was 4 whole months ago. That's like an eternity ago. See, that's the problem is I'm always in one of these giant brawls, and it just, like, the actual... topic shifts and the people shift, but for me it's just every day. It's always somebody. So yeah. Anyway, Richard, you may have thought that I was a bully in terms of the vaccine, in terms of the convoy. Look, I still support getting the vaccine. I got the vaccine. Everybody should get boosted too. It makes a difference. Is it perfect? No, there's no such thing as what's perfect, but it does make a difference. And I really do believe that we prevented thousands of COVID cases that otherwise would have happened, that otherwise would have been a lot more serious than they actually were. And we cannot help but have at least indirectly saved lives while doing that. It's probably in the thousands of lives too, if we want to look at the island. There's a million people on this island. And we had a shockingly low death count, at least up until I was going to say the end of the pandemic, even though it hasn't really ended yet. So yeah, don't get mad at me, man. All of us were doing what we thought we were supposed to do, what we needed to do. None of us wanted to do it. It hurt the whole time. It was uncomfortable the whole time. It was difficult the whole time. I wanted to quit the whole time, but I didn't let myself. I knew I had to push through, and I knew that if I just said whatever, I'd be letting everybody down. So when I was yelling about taking names and all this other stuff, I was yelling at myself because it was weaker parts of me were tired. I was hurting. I wanted to quit. And I said, no, I'm not going to quit. I'm going to stand and I'm going to fight and I'm going to punch and punch and punch and punch until either my body gives out and I just drop dead or we win this thing. Neither of those things has actually happened yet. But we're closer to winning, I think, in terms of putting this pandemic behind us than my body dropping dead, hopefully. So, yeah, no, I did all that stuff. I'd kind of forgotten about it, though, with all the recent stuff. Let's go to Jeet. Hey, Jeet, you're on the air. How you doing?
Good morning, Adam. Adam, yeah, you sound like Andrew Tate this morning sometimes.
Hey, no, I don't, Jeet. Don't say that. Don't say that. Don't say it, Jeet. I'm serious. They'll use it. Don't say it.
But you know what? I mean, I hope someone does something, you know, serious with the housing. And, you know, I own a taxi. Then my driver came yesterday and he's like, you know, complaining about, you know, he's like, he's from Australia, right? He's like, you know, what's wrong here in Canada? He's like, you know, why can't we buy a house and this and this? You know, Australia government fixed it. Like, it's like they, did some changes to for foreign buyers, for the people living in the country, make it more possible to get a mortgage. Even in the UK, got rid of the stress test. So, end of the day, I say, well, welcome to Canada. We have the smartest government, right? That's where people took advantage of our country. But I don't want to go there. But end of the day, you know, I don't know, man. I don't know how you're going to fix this. It's going to get worse and worse, right? People don't care about the laws. That's why you have looting in the States and so on here. It's going to get worse and worse, right? I hope someone takes control and makes some changes. It benefits the people, right? And I'll leave it at that. But I don't know, man. We need doctors. We need a lot of things, right? And
yeah,
and
we do.
People don't see. You know what? There's a girl sitting on 2 weeks ago. She was playing hockey, and you know, and she was on the ice for 5 hours waiting for a paramedic, right? And you know, seniors are same thing. You know, waiting for paramedics, right? Yeah. And while I know Trudeau's a nice guy, but we need someone to take in charge and just fix this, man.
Well, we're expecting...
We have a great country, right? Let's make it better now.
We're expecting an announcement later today, G, from the province, some sort of human resourcing plan for the healthcare, if we want to use the word industry, service sector, whatever we want to call it. So hopefully there will be some sort of a plan. I think the province is going to be announcing it later on today, I recall hearing. And I don't know exactly what it is, what it will entail, but I do know that we desperately need more resources. We need more resources just about everywhere. And that's one of the reasons why it's so frustrating when I see something that's malfunctioning by choice, is we have all these other aspects of just society and governance right now where everybody's on the same page. Everybody wants it to work. There's no division. We're all just saying, please, please, please. And that stuff's starting to fail. And the discourse seems focused on, let's create new things. And I'm thinking, what we have is corroding and crumbling right before our eyes. And all we seem to focus on is how we're going to create these new things. And sure, maybe that's just how politics works. You have to find something new and exciting and shiny to entice the electorate. But it feels like our core responsibilities are crumbling to dust and nobody's doing anything about it. And I know people are, but it feels like why won't somebody save us? Why won't somebody do something? How is it possible this is happening? And yet it is. I lack the language to articulate the combination of emotions with bewilderment and frustration and exasperation that combine when I try to contemplate what's actually happening. And I don't know how to, I wish I was more articulate, because I can't express it in a way that feels satisfying. It's like it's stuck and I can't quite describe what is so wrong with it other than it feels like just insanity. Like we're losing life support, in other words, like in terms of how society functions. And we're sitting around arguing about what new hood ornament we should get for the spaceship when like the warp core is breaching, like right now. And we're all sitting there arguing about other stuff. It's madness. It really feels like madness. Anyway, I digress. Let's go to, hey, BJ, how you doing?
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I'm okay.
I just thought I was mentioned to you yesterday. I accidentally went on YouTube, and lo and behold, I saw something I never thought I'd ever see anybody do.
Oh no! What is this going to be?
That was Ben Izzet questioning a developer about 902 Foul Bay, and asking the guy, did you have anything to do with the arson at 902 Foul Bay?
Yeah, no, we discussed that on the show, BJ. You must have missed that segment.
I just about fell over.
I'll tell you what the issue was, because we checked into this, because I know ISIS said that, and everybody went, what are you even talking about now? There was a suspicious fire in 2016. It was the first time a demolition permit had ever been issued, or likely the first time a demolition permit had ever been issued for a heritage-designated home that had burned down like that, is what Pam Madoff and others said in 2016, February, when the permit for demolition was approved after the fire. There was a person who was arrested who was the owner within the next year, but charges were never brought. The property got sold to a different developer. That different developer, over the next couple of years, put together a large number of iterations. It was originally going to be affordable housing, the AHOP project, that's affordable a home ownership program with the BC Housing, and then that ended up not happening. It ended up being CRD. Anyway, bottom line is that there was a fire. It was suspicious. There was an arrest, but there were never any charges brought, but it was not the current developer who was owning the property at the time. So ICIT could have been just trying to establish a timeline when he said that to exonerate the current developer in case anybody was confused.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, I thought, you know, if it had been me, if he'd have been questioning me, I'd have walked up and punched him right in the mouth.
Well, we don't want anybody to punch anybody at City Hall, BJ. But I can tell you, you know, it's, yeah, like I want everybody to be clear on this, too. It was a different person who owned the property. It wasn't until a large gap later that the current developer took over the property. And it's important that everybody knows that.
So now we all know why not to vote for Ben Izzet.
Well, I mean, some people, you can take whatever you want as a reason to or to not vote for somebody. We have a political climate where people love the rebel, they love the radical, like they love the sort of norm violating, proudly brash, brazen personality. So some people will actually probably be more likely to vote for him, but others less. But it is what it is.
Well, he's not just brash; he's a gunslinger.
Well, people did laugh when he said it.
And he loves Putin.
I don't know if he loves Putin and that he's ever said that. He did, however, say that he didn't want Victoria Council to get involved in the debate over the Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014, suggesting that it was a question of international law. That was when they had the debate about suspending the Twin City relationship with Khabarovsk, Russia. Khabarovsk, Russia is, by the way, I think it's 7 time zones east of Moscow. It's thousands of kilometers away from Moscow. It's not exactly the sort of territory that is seen to be central in the Russian Federation. And ICIT actually had pictures of himself on a trip near Khabarovsk with school children that he produced during the debate, talking about how he was reluctant to cut off diplomatic ties with Khabarovsk, Russia, suggesting that perhaps those children at this time might be teachers that are currently either working in or around Khabarovsk. And he had the picture of himself on the train. So, you know, he's been to Russia. He's a complicated guy, but all of us are, I suppose. Just those in the public eye, we tend to get a better look at sometimes, as I have a shocking moment of self-awareness. Nope, we're just going to push that one right down. All right, quick break, 250-386-1161. Back with more calls after this.
It's Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
All right, we're back on the air here at CFAX 1070, 250-386-1161, star 1070, a free call on your wireless device. Let's go to John, who's calling in. Hey, John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Adam. Just a couple of things. First of all, I'm in favor of 30 kilometers per hour on side streets. Yeah. I think that's a pretty good idea.
How are we going to police it, or are we?
Well, we'll have to let them figure that out, but I believe that they should have them, like they have school zones, but they can't be everywhere at once. But if somebody has an accident and they're going over 30, they'll soon find out. Anyway, on another subject, the needles.
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting my 4th COVID shot.
Yeah.
And also, I'm going to get a flu shot because I've been told the flu is going to be a bit nastier this year than usual.
That's a good idea. You know, it's recommended to get vaccines, and I don't know how they became controversial, are one of the most important technological advancements that our species, humanity, has ever come up with. Like, they are on par with the wheel and the lever and anesthesia in terms of medical technology. But the ability to give our immune system a safe, practice, like a target at the shooting range to train itself on, so that when it encounters the real thing, it's more capable of doing so, is a miracle of science. And I don't know why anybody should or would be convinced to be afraid of that. It's just it's so wrong that so many people have been frightened of what they shouldn't be.
Right. And just one other thing I meant to mention, too, is I'm afraid Eby is going to try to run the province the same way Helps and ISIT like to run the city. Just watch what happens.
John, I think we will watch one way or the other, okay?
Thanks very much.
All right. Have a good day. 250-386-1161 star 1070. Yeah, I guess things got a little heated between myself and the convoy, like when I told them that they needed to leave my island. So I don't want to belabor the point on the on the convoy stuff today. They're leaving my island. And they really did say they were, like, leaving my island. Like, they actually said it that way.
So there you have it. Look, we're officially moving. For all you trolls that don't like us, we are leaving your island.
You'd think the progressives would give me a little bit of credit for that, but nope, still considered public enemy number one, still hate my guts, still doing everything they can to try to shut me up. You're welcome, by the way. Not that I wanted or needed your thanks anyway. I do what I think is right, and I don't care if it's left, right, up, down, progressive, conservative, whatever. I'm going to tell the side that I think is in the wrong that I think it's in the wrong, and hopefully, eventually, we see eye to eye. But yeah, no, the convoy saga, that's a hell of a thing. How did I forget about all that? Anyway, let's go to our next call. It's going to be, hey, Rishi, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Adam. Rishi Sharma here.
Hey, Sanish candidate, Rishi Sharma. What's up?
Well, first I want to say thanks for being so accessible. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your contributions, your insights, and your views. So thanks for me. But I wanted to call in to say that, there's an all-candidates debate tonight.
Yeah.
At Reynolds Secondary School in the theater, and yeah. Usually this one it's huge, like 200 people. And I wanted to invite folks to come to have their voice heard, because their voice matters. And we had one the other day, and it was fantastic. It was out in Cordova Bay. But I just want to let people know, in Saanich, you know, these are ongoing, they're continuing, and we want people to come out and join the process. I kind of sound like your Saanich correspondent now.
Well, I was just going to say, and I want to thank you for reminding us. So, hey, Saanich voters, you live in the largest municipality in the Victoria area. There's more than 110,000 of you. If you want to hear your candidates and their ideas for how they would like the municipality to move forward, Reynolds Secondary School, it's on Borden Street, right?
Yes.
What time is it this evening, Rishi?
6:30 tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a lot of us. We don't have much time to talk about ourselves, about 45 seconds each, a few questions, 45 seconds, and we move on. But you can meet the candidates. We're all going to be there. We'll all be shaking hands. We can hand out our pamphlets, our information, and it's a good way to really get to know us, put a face to a name. But Adam, I also wanted to talk about Evie's...
What do you make of that?
Very welcome. Our family have built residential homes and townhouses for, you know, over 20 years. I've been part of the process with my dad. I've built my own homes, and at every step, there's been roadblocks.
Yeah,
and again, this is for since the '80s. It's always been a no, no, no. It's always been so difficult, and so it's very welcomed, and I appreciate it. But there was one piece, and I sent a tweet about this as well, is about the process-oriented aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot of gray area and a lot of questions there that I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And we're struggling. Like, so municipalities, if we can put in a request, if I get at the table, it would be like, can we also have capital funding for some of our IT-related infrastructures? And I know Saanich is doing this, but moving out of that slow paper-based to more electronic-based, you know, finding out how we can train individuals to start moving from other areas of the municipality into the planning department so we can get these applications put through. Like, my God, mine for a simple two-lot subdivision is 2.5 years. And wow. How can we actually get housing built if I'm sitting here, and I'm not a developer by any means, but we build homes,
yeah,
and it's very expensive. So now I'm sitting on these delays, and it's costly.
Yeah,
and I would like to have a home built. I'd like a garden suite built. I'd like a secondary suite as well, so we can house some students at a reasonable rate. I never jack my rent up. I think that's, you know, we have to help our students as well. But these are the types of things I wanted to ask him and see if we can get to a solution for some funding to help municipalities process these things and get the applications through so we can get this immediate housing bill.
Well said. Rishi Sharma, Saanich candidate, thanks for calling in for the update. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
All right. Have yourself a great day. And once again, that debate, all candidates, and I encourage folks to go out to the all candidates debates, actually see these candidates in person. Be polite, of course. Be courteous. Be civil. That's what we want to see in these matters. I know the Susan Simmons debate, or not debate, it was a walk, got canceled for this weekend. I don't want to hear anything like that happening in this region. I want to be very clear about that, that I will denounce that. I don't care which side it is. I don't care what the ideology is. I just don't want to hear about it happening. Reynolds Secondary School this evening, Saanich candidates. You can head out there. It's on Borden Street, 3963 Borden, just after 6 o'clock tonight. All right, quick break. Legally Speaking is coming up. Don't go anywhere.
Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Into the second half of our second hour on a Thursday here at CFAX 1070. That means it's time for our regular segment, Legally Speaking, joined by Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. Good morning, Michael. How are we doing?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Always good to be here.
There are some contentious and interesting stories on the docket this week, including a matter involving a woman in her 20s engaging in sexual relations with a teenage boy and the sentence handed down following those encounters. What can you tell us?
Yes, indeed. And this is a local case from Western Communities. The first thing to be aware of, by way of background, is that in Canada there was a change in 2008 to the age of consent for sexual activity. Prior to the change in 2008, the age that somebody was allowed to legally consent to sexual activity was 14. And in 2008, they increased that from 14 to 16. But they did include a couple of exceptions. There are exceptions including what are sometimes referred to as close-in-age exceptions, and that would mean that somebody who is within 2 years of somebody who's 12 or 13, right, there could be consent for, you know, you don't want to be prosecuting two young people who are consensually doing something.
Yes.
And as well, there's an exception for close-in-age of 5 years for where the complainant is 14 or 15 years of age. So that would allow a 15-year-old to consent to activity for somebody who's up to 20, depending if you just look at their birthdays.
Yeah.
Now, those don't always apply. Like, they wouldn't apply if there was some position of trust or authority, right? So it's not, you have to be careful with that. And then there's another issue, which is an issue involving mistaken belief in somebody's age.
Hmm.
Because in the criminal law, we punish people who knowingly do something wrong,
yes,
right? We don't generally punish people for mistakes. But with respect to age and ability to consent, there's a special provision in the criminal code that provides that if somebody's relying upon a mistake in age, they are required to take all reasonable steps to determine the age of the person. Now, that can be a sliding scale of,
yeah,
what would be required.
All steps. That's
the case we're dealing with.
Yeah, the word all,
would be
really,
all reasonable.
Yeah.
Now, there could be some circumstances where all reasonable steps would be nothing more than looking at the person, right?
Hmm.
No offense, but I'm sure if somebody looked at you, they would need to take no other steps to determine that you're over the age of 16.
Indeed,
right?
Yes.
You look at it, you say, okay, that's all I need to do, right? But if you ran into somebody at the junior high school, well, you better be checking birth certificates, getting affidavits, interviewing people, you know, lie detector tests. You could get there, but boy, you better be thorough. Now, that brings us to the case, the local case we're dealing with. And one of the interesting things about it are the gender rules, because the accused in this case was a 24 or 25-year-old woman. It was a little unclear on the evidence.
Hmm.
And the complainant was a 15-year-old. And the context was that the 15-year-old with some other young people met the accused and another woman and offered to swap marijuana for alcohol.
Hmm.
And they wound up having a party together. And the party led to lap dancing and clothes coming off and eventually sexual activity between the, either it was unclear, 24 or 25-year-old woman and the 15-year-old. And there was also evidence in this case that the 15-year-old may have claimed to have been 18 years of age. As well, there was evidence that the woman had asked him about that. Are you sure you're 18? And again, the answer was yes. And then her evidence was, he said, I wouldn't be here if I wasn't. And then also the evidence was that not only was there in a, not in a legal way, but in a sort of factual way, the 15-year-old boy was very eager to engage in the sexual activity. But that doesn't matter from a legal perspective. If the person isn't of age where they're, in, as a matter of law, able to consent, right? No matter how willing the person might appear, that's not sufficient. And here, the judge found that the onus, of course, remains on the adult. And even where you've got somebody who's very eager, and even where they may have claimed to have been older, the judge found that the woman had not taken all reasonable steps to inquire. And the judge took into account things like there was a doubt in her mind because she asked him, are you sure you're 18, right? But she said, there's also, well, yes, right? But, you know, on the circumstances and fact pattern here, that wasn't enough. And so the woman was convicted of sexual assault for engaging in this activity with the 15-year-old. Then internet luring, because she sent a text message to him a short time later saying, you want to come over for a hot makeout sesh? That was internet luring. And then he did come over, and they engaged in sexual activity again. And he was, she was sentenced to, and this is despite the fact that she had no previous record, that the judge found she was a low risk to reoffend, the fact that she had been sexually assaulted when she was a child, and the fact that she had herself a child that she took care of. Despite all those factors, the judge sentenced her to 5.5 years in the penitentiary. And in so doing, the judge made reference to the fact that there was a Supreme Court of Canada case dealing with sentencing where the court said mid-range penitentiary terms should be not exceptional where there's a conviction for sexual assault involving a child. And the judge concluded that it would be, and this is sort of an interesting analysis of it, he said it would be unfair to men who were convicted to not impose such a long sentence on a woman, which is an interesting analysis. I'm not sure how, quite how, I scratched my head a little bit at that. I'm not sure that the fairness to other people necessarily would be a an element in sentencing, but the judge found that it was not, I suppose, a mitigating or a factor that the accused was female and not male, and as well, the judge found that it would not be appropriate to reduce the sentence, taking into account that the woman who was convicted was the mother of a child who she took care of. And she said, look, the judge said, look, there are other people. The father could take care of the child or a relative. And so a very substantial penitentiary sentence handed out on that fact pattern, which has a number of thought-provoking elements to it people should be aware of, starting with that issue of taking all reasonable steps. And even though in this case, the evidence seems to be that the 15-year-old claimed to be older, and she may have even asked him again about that, and there were some other elements. Of course, this person's got marijuana. That might be some indication of something, because there's a need to do that. But none of that was enough. More was required. And then even though this person could have consented if this had occurred in 2008, that doesn't matter. The law changed. Interestingly, there was another woman who was also charged. She was acquitted, and it would appear she didn't testify. And the reason for the acquittal, she engaged allegedly in some sexual activity with another young person. There was no evidence as to how old she was. And so the problem became, it was unclear to the judge whether the there was a gap of less than 5 years between her and the other person. Because if somebody is 15, you could consent to sexual activity with somebody who's 19, for example. And if you don't know how old the accused is, you can't tell that. And so in that case, the judge acquitted. But this woman, this accused, testified, and she wanted to give the evidence, I suppose, about asking him his age and him confirming the age and so on. But in so doing, she had to provide her own age. And so the result for her was a conviction and now a very long penitentiary sentence.
All right. Let's take our first break here at CFAX 1070. Legally speaking, we'll continue with analysis of a recent decision involving Victoria School Board trustees. I'm very interested to hear Michael's thoughts on this matter right after this.
You're listening to Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Back on the air here at CFAX 1070 as we continue with Legally Speaking, Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers, helping us better understand recent legal decisions and their implications in the community. Now, Michael, this next one is one that I actually was asked about on the program, and I declined to comment because the legalities of it were beyond my ability to understand. It involves the Greater Victoria School Board and whether or not authority existed to suspend two elected trustees. Help us understand all this.
Yes, indeed. So, first of all, I should say thank you to everyone who's doing things like serving on school boards or running for municipal office. I'm sure in many cases it's a pretty thankless task. In Victoria, the background of this, according to the decision that just came out, was that there had been for some period of time a split on the school boards at School District 61 in Victoria. A five-trustee majority and a four-trustee minority on the board who had apparently disagreements about things.
Yes.
And the case involved two of the minority. And the there were allegations made that the two members of the minority group of four on the school board had engaged in behavior that was harassing or disrespectful with respect to staff members. Staff members of the board. And it was alleged that those occurred online and at meetings. That was the essence of it.
Yes.
And so the majority of the board had an investigation done into that, found that the two minority members had done that, in their view, and decided to suspend them from continuing to sit on the board.
Yes.
And so that decision to suspend the two and not let them attend meetings went to court, not surprisingly, and the BC Supreme Court judge concluded that the board lacked legal authority to do what they did. They simply weren't permitted to suspend elected members on that basis. And the legal analysis involved the judge analyzing the School Act. We have an act for everything, including the School Act. And the approach that the board, the majority of the board took, or what they argued, was even though the School Act doesn't have any specific provision that allows for the majority to suspend elected representatives because of alleged misconduct, they argued that by necessary implication, that must be allowed. Oh. And so when that kind of an argument is made, what a judge is doing is they're looking at the legislation, trying to figure out, is this something which is required by necessary implication, right? Sometimes if legislation says you can do X, it's sort of implied. It must have meant the legislature included, or, you know, contemplated doing Y to allow you to do X, right? And so that's what the judge was analyzing. But ultimately, the judge concluded that no, the School Act had amounted to what the judge found to be a complete code dealing with when somebody could be disqualified from holding office. Like, for example, the School Act provides that if a trustee refuses to take the oath of office, they're disqualified. Or if a trustee is continually absent from board meetings for a period of 3 consecutive months, unless that's a result of illness, they can be disqualified, and so on. And so the judge said, look, the legislature passing the School Act did contemplate various circumstances in which somebody could be disqualified. They failed to show up, they won't take their oath of office, etc. And so that's it. You can't have a circumstance where the majority decides to prevent the elected representatives from showing up and, you know, performing their elected roles, right? You can imagine what mischief could come of that.
Yeah.
Right? It's, you know, you just can't have a circumstance where a government says, for example, we're a majority, we are going to exclude the opposition from the legislature.
Well, exactly. Right?
They're disrespectful.
Yeah.
The system can't function that way. And well, I appreciate the argument about sort of necessary implication, and I appreciate as well sort of the arguments about, you know, boy, we have to somehow keep control of things, right?
Yes.
and in some cases, I should say, and it's not an argument which is completely from left field, because the school board referenced circumstances where city councils had taken some steps when members had, for example, one case involved a member, it looked like, releasing confidential information.
Yes.
Right? And in that case, the city council passed a motion of censure, that's sort of a nominal thing, and then removed the individual from sitting on particular committees, for example, for a period of time. But it wasn't as if they were, you know, removed entirely from city council because they didn't like how they'd conducted themselves. And so that was an example of something which, in the context of local government and this different piece of legislation, found that that was by necessary implication the kind of thing that could be done to censure somebody for some serious misconduct. But that's a different thing from, you know, not allowing the person to act in their elected role at all, right? That would be sort of in the legislative example. It would be like saying, okay, we don't want this MLA to be on the, you know, vacation committee or something, and we're going to pass a resolution saying your behavior is inappropriate. That's a different thing from telling an elected person you can't participate at all because you've just disenfranchised all the people who voted for that person, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not as if there's a circumstance where nothing can be done, but what was done here, the judge found, was not authorized by the legislation, is obviously has the possibility of pretty serious mischief if you have elected people unable to continue. And as well, I suppose my other view of it when I read this decision is, you know, I think we do sometimes have this sort of expectation that a person's going to be completely canceled as a result of some behavior that, you know, may or may not have been appropriate. I don't form any judgment on that. I don't, it's not even clear here precisely what these people did or were alleged to have done, right? But it's not always necessary, at least in my view, that the response to, even if conduct was not appropriate in some way, say we want to completely cancel this person so they can't show up at all, that seems like it may be over the top. But the judge here found that they didn't need to get into an analysis of procedural fairness or any of those things simply because the board lacked the authority to do what it did. And so these two people are now back on the board right before the election, and the school board has been ordered to pay the legal costs resulting from this decision. So the two minority people are back, and I guess we'll see what the voters think in the upcoming election.
All right. Thanks for helping us understand that one, because it was a complicated one. And I know people who are involved, like Ryan Painter, the chair of the board, has been on these airwaves any number of times over the years. So I didn't really want to get into trying to analyze this one. So I really appreciate your analysis, Michael. Thank you.
And once again, thank you for everyone. It's amazing to me for some of these positions, which would be time-consuming and pay little, to spend a whole bunch of time working on issues that could be important to a lot of people. It's amazing to me that there is a election for school board and that there are more people than our seats willing to do that work. I would have thought with some of these positions, it would be a matter of sending out a dragnet trying to dragoon people into spending their evenings.
It's a punishment. That.
Not a, you know, hotly contested matter with factions and so on, but anyways, it's a good sign for democracy, and I suppose bodes well for volunteerism generally that you've got people willing to spend their time doing it. So thank you to everyone who's been serving in that way and are running and volunteering to do it. It's pretty remarkable.
Absolutely. We have 5 minutes remaining in our segment, and one more story. An appeal of a decision dismissing a human rights tribunal claim of discrimination, and there's a firing an academic advisor. There's a dating app involved here. What's this all about?
Yeah, so this was a person who was an academic advisor at UBC, and the academic advisor was using a dating app for gay men. And the dating app is one which would be based on your geographical location. Like it would, I guess, try to hook people up who were nearby. And the challenge for the academic advisor, I guess, were twofold. One was that he at some point had linked up that he was enlisted, that he was, in fact, a UBC academic advisor on the app. and then he had his address where all the students were. And he wound up through the app meeting, I think it was sort of 20 students, one of whom was somebody he had advised. Although that person, there was some meeting arranged, but that person didn't show up. And UBC got wind of this, and they fired him. And he made a human rights complaint. And his human rights complaint was that he alleged he had been discriminated against based on his sexual orientation. Because he said, well, you wouldn't have done this, or he didn't think that would have happened if somebody was using a dating app for people who weren't gay. And so that was the issue for the Human Rights Tribunal. Now, the University of British Columbia applied to the Human Rights Tribunal to have the claim dismissed without even having a hearing. And they succeeded. And so that resulted in the fired academic advisor bringing a judicial review, first to the BC Supreme Court, and then to the BC Court of Appeal, which is what brought us to the decision that just came out. And the fired academic advisor was arguing that there would be some reason to believe that his sexual orientation was at least part of, or may have played a part in the decision to fire him rather than impose some lesser penalty. And he pointed out that there were other people who worked at the university who were on other dating apps and they weren't fired. And he pointed out as well that at the time there was no express provision in the UBC code of conduct that said an employee could not engage in intimate activity with a student. There were provisions that talked about not using inherent power imbalance or for personal benefits, sort of more generic terminology.
Yes.
But he pointed out there wasn't an express prohibition on that. And so he wanted to have an opportunity to, I suppose, at a hearing, be able to ask questions and try to explore whether there was some element of discrimination based on sexual orientation. And that's an interesting argument when the case was struck out by the Human Rights Tribunal without even having a hearing. They just said, look, this cannot succeed. And ultimately, the way the Court of Appeal approached it is that they were looking at what is the appropriate test for the Human Rights Tribunal dismissing an application outright without first conducting a hearing, and then was their exercise of discretion in that regard unreasonable in a way that a court could interfere with it. And the Court of Appeal concluded, and was referencing an earlier decision, that the mere possibility of discrimination cannot be enough to require a hearing. And they said, well, you know, there can be circumstances where you can point to reasonable inferences that can be drawn that might make it past that test, but mere speculation that that might have been a factor isn't going to be enough to get you a hearing. So, right, there's no doubt that, you know, those sort of the basic facts aren't just, you know, aren't disputed. He was using a gay dating app. There are other people that used other apps that weren't aimed at gay men that weren't fired. But on the other hand, there were some elements here, like, you know, evidence that he posted on his profile that he worked at UBC and he was connecting with students. And one of the students he connected with was somebody he had counseled.
Yes.
Right. So the point that the Court of Appeal made was that the original tribunal decision dismissing it was a reasonable one because speculation is not enough. Right. You can't just say, well, I think this was a factor, or I believe it or could have been, and so I want a hearing to be able to explore whether it was. And so the Court of Appeal upheld both the tribunal decision, the judicial review, and this is, as a result, likely the end of it, finding that this fact pattern was not enough to proceed, and the decision made by the tribunal to dismiss it was an appropriate one.
Michael Mulligan, a pleasure as always. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
All right. During the second half of our second hour every Thursday on CFAX 1070, Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan, barrister and solicitor with Mulligan Defense Lawyers. We'll be right back.